Mobility Africa platform, which brings us these types of webinars all around how we advance the movement of people and goods in urban areas across Africa. So I'm thrilled to be here with you all today as we discuss a really important topic. This topic is around financing electric fleets. And it's important because the industry around electric vehicles is not being held back necessarily because of technology today. In fact, the technology has advanced so much since the first electric vehicles really started to become mass market potential 10 or 15 years ago. One of the big challenges faced across the world and faced increasingly so in different parts of Africa is around financing. So how do you finance these great technologies? How do you finance fleets so that these solutions can really be scaled to reduce emissions, reduce costs, make businesses and countries more competitive, and move away from the burning of fossil fuels? So the other point that's really interesting to bear in mind with electric vehicles is that the demand is increasing. So fleet managers and end users are really taking it seriously now and looking at how can they embrace electric vehicle technology today. So we'll be looking at that specifically around fleets. In all markets around the world, it's been the commercial and fleet section of the automotive sector that's really driven demand and uptake for electric vehicles, which is why it's really important that we are understanding the challenges and opportunities that fleets are facing to electrify their fleets. So I'm really excited for today. Cash is king, as we always say, and money talks. So the more that we can understand how that money can flow, the better. So today we've got three expert speakers, and we can actually bring them all up right now. And I'll do a brief introduction to everybody. So today we have three speakers, three professionals coming from different sides of the industry, looking at it from a fleet management perspective, from a microfinancing perspective, from a leasing services perspective. So it gives us a really well-rounded overview of what's happening at the moment in fleets. So we have, from the top of my screen and around, Jonathan Mpake, who's the National Fleet Manager at the SPV Group. Good morning. Welcome to the webinar today. We also have Steve. Hey. Sorry, Jonathan, we'll come to you in a minute as well. There might be a bit of a delay. Who is the CFO at Watsu Credit. We have Paul Plummer, who's the co-founder of Evelectric and Black Slope. And it's great to have all of you with us today. So in just a sec, we'll be going around and just understanding what your role in the industry is, what it is that you guys actually offer. So I think let's kick that off, and we'll head straight over to SPV. So what's your role within this ecosystem, and what is it that you offer as an organization?
Thank you very much, Ben. So as you said, my name is Jonathan, the National Fleet Manager for SPV. Basically, what we do is cash in transit delivery. We are owned by the four major banks in South Africa. We're the only cash in transit company that collects money from the SARB and distributes it through the value chain. Basically, my background is in fleet management. I'm responsible for the management of the fleet, making sure that we purchase the right vehicles, dispose it correctly, and looking at the ESG component of the organization. I've also inaugural winner of the Best Fleet Manager Award at the Fleet Managers Awards that was held 2 years ago, and also in the industry represent a lot of fleet managers through the upcoming Association for Fleet Professionals. Thank you.
That's brilliant, Jonathan. So we've got a win-win with you. Not only are we talking about financing fleets, we've got the guy who manages the fleet that actually moves that money around the country. So great to have you with us. And we have Steve from Watsu. So what does Watsu Credit do? What's your role within this ecosystem?
Thank you, Ben. And I'm quite happy to be part of this panel, discuss this very timely, topic. So as you mentioned, I'm the CFO for Watsu. And basically my role is to know end-to-end management of finance. But what does Watu do? So Watu is a non-deposit taking asset finance company that started in Kenya in the year 2015, basically to try and solve the challenges faced by Africans in terms of accessing affordable and flexible financing. And initially when we started in the coastal area of Kenya, we were basically financing women groups. Around 2017, through the visionary leadership of our founders, Watu started financing income generating vehicles. So this was predominantly two-wheelers and three-wheelers, what we call motorbikes and, you know, tuk-tuks here around East Africa. Commencing 2019, Watu went outside the borders of Kenya and expanded into various countries. And right now we are present in seven countries. That is Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, Nigeria, and DRC, who is the new kid on the block. And we are almost going into the South African market and the Ethiopian market. We've also diversified our products. So initially we started with two-wheelers, three-wheelers. Now we sort of like finance mobile phones, commencing 2022. And we believe that the financing of mobile phones is actually intertwined with our strategy for funding EVs, which we can, you know, talk about later. Watu in Africa has over 3,000 employees. We've given over 1 million loans. And we believe that we've impacted over, you know, 4 million lives. Let me highlight also a bit in Uganda. We do not only finance in Uganda. Uganda is our second biggest market after Kenya. But we have also invested in an electric company that is called Gogo Electric that actually manufactures EV batteries, electric two-wheeler EV batteries, and also retrofits, you know, motors and what we call CKDs, completely knockdown parts, to come up with a two-wheeler EV. So we are not only a financier, but a manufacturer. Yeah, so that's just a nutshell of what we do.
Brilliant. Thanks, Steve. And within that nutshell, who are your key customers? So I've heard microfinancing of individuals. Do you also finance fleets, or is the focus on the individual end user?
Yeah, so currently it's purely financing individuals for all our products, be it two-wheelers, phones, and even EVs.
Great stuff. And Paul, Evelectric, what's your role in this ecosystem and what is it that you're offering?
Right, thanks Ben, thanks Jonathan, Steve. I've got a tough act to follow. Yeah, you guys are super impressive, so I'm gonna have to make up some stuff now. It's Paul Plummer. We co-founded Evelectric 2019, so we're an electric vehicle as a service business, which is a business that tries to reduce the barriers of adoption of electric vehicles, predominantly in the B2B space. So, you know, we're targeting business fleets, and our hypothesis is that electric vehicles should operationally be the same or better. Commercially, it needs to be the same or better. And then the third leg, which it stands on, is there's a number of technical things which you need to solve in order to adopt. I call it the poiki. If the poiki stands, then we fulfill the promise and we'll be able to help our clients go electric and, you know, carbon free, and drive EVs into businesses. My past achievements include winning the best hair at Deloitte Award, as you can see.
I'm a recovered
chartered accountant. Indeed, I'm a recovered chartered accountant that now is no longer have an urge to add things on a calculator every time I see it. We have successfully launched our electric vehicle business over the last three odd years. We started with trials, so we started with 5 electric vehicles and some Excel spreadsheets and a PowerPoint promise. We currently own over 100 electric vehicles. Unfortunately, we haven't touched 1 million people and we don't have 3,000 employees, but we do have vehicles completing commercial kilometers every day in our country. from last year, June, July was really when we scaled our first commercial operations, and we've completed about 2.5 million kilometers of commercial electric vehicles deliveries. And you know, I suppose I signed up to this to share some of my insights on, you know, on financing electric fleets, but also listening to the co-presenters and other people's ideas in this space always helps develop your thinking around this. And so, you know, maybe I signed up just to get inside notes from Steve and Jonathan.
Brilliant. That's what it's all about. And this definitely is a free-flowing webinar. For our panelists, but also for people watching. And if you've got questions, then there's a Q&A section and a comment section in the chat in the Hopin platform that you're on. So as the audience, definitely put questions in. We want to hear your thoughts, your experiences, your concerns. And I'm sure across our panelists, we'll be able to get some of those answers. So let's actually dive into your customers. So Jonathan, you probably are the customer, and Paul plays the role of both, and I imagine Steve does to some extent as well. But what are the key challenges being faced by fleet managers and your clients from a funding perspective when looking at electric vehicles? So I'll open that up to anybody that wants to add some contribution around that.
So I think I'll jump in there, Ben. From just the basics in terms of the overarching idea, one needs to understand from a starting point the science that fleet management is. A lot of times people look at it as purchasing vehicles, that's the only thing that matters. But when you're talking about fleet management, you're talking about a subset in supply chain management. You're talking about the understanding of how do I procure the vehicle? What type of vehicle? For what application am I procuring it for? And in terms of understanding then the analysis from a cents per kilometer, in other words, running costs and the total cost of ownership perspective, and understanding the full life cycle or the full lifespan of that vehicle from cradle to the grave, how you dispose it. So that science and understanding that will inform what you do in terms of purchasing or starting at the starting point. We know in fleet management and supply chain management and logistics that fuel is probably the second, if not the highest cost after labor. So you are always conflicted and you're always looking at how do I reduce carbon emission? How do I run my vehicles fuel efficient as a good corporate citizen? But then all of that ESG, all of that components come into when you're trying to buy, and the impediments that start from there. Then you will start looking at buy-in from certain individuals in the organization. There are a lot of people that still have the major perception that, you know, internal combustion engines is the way to go, especially looking at the continent. There's a very deep belief from some people who have been in old school fleet management that should not change, it cannot change, that this is somehow fluffy and, you know, flowery. You have to get your internal buy-in. Then you're looking at the legislative component, what tax breaks, what sort of initiatives is the government supplying to make it easy. But for you as the individual fleet manager, you have to start with what is the capital expenditure as well. Am I willing to spend to try to either buy the vehicles, depending on the size and the appetite for your business, to lease the vehicles, or do whatever component. But I think the biggest challenge would be from the practicality side of it, any transporter wants a return on investment. They want to be able to know in terms of the full life cycle of the vehicle, how will I make my money back? And will I satisfy the needs of my customers? You know, so a lot of, you know, when I talk to industry people, that's the crux of it. We're looking at, do I do CapEx? Do I do lease? Do I do rental? Do I do a partnership with the OEMs? What do I do? And once I've done that, any fleet guy will say to you, what is the fuel consumption? Okay, change my mindset. What is the energy consumption? What is the energy depletion? How do I manage it? What is the whole total cost? And if I have repairs, what are the components? How are they expensive? Are they different from the normal diesel vehicle? So it's the whole plethora of the total usage of the vehicle, plus the initiation phase that kind of trips up a lot of fleet managers and becomes an impediment for us. Thanks.
I can see, it's more complex than one might first think. And just in terms of that science, when have you seen that science go completely wrong? And, you know, this might be from some of your contacts in the network. When have they, you know, taken a scientific fleet management decision and a year or two down the line just realized, oh, we've lost a lot of money because we've taken this decision or that decision? What would be a good example of when it doesn't go right?
100%, Ben. So I'm looking at it without exposing some of my friends or myself, but, you know, it starts with, we did a, and I won't mention, even if the people look for me or look at my past on LinkedIn, they won't tell which company this was. But we did a decision with excitement, with, you know, procurement and everybody to buy a certain type of vehicle and put it in a certain type of area. Knowing that it's long distance, you know, the fuel consumption should be great and on, but you began to notice that the running costs were higher because the vehicle needed to be repaired at a much more higher rate, which has a economic impact than what we initially thought and what we budgeted for. So now the issue was, why is this happening? The stuff on paper said that the CPK for this vehicle is X. We load Y. We are not over. We should be able to deliver in time. And a lot of people confuse from a supply chain logistics perspective, on-time delivery to on-time delivered in full, which is what you want from your customer. You want to get there on time, keep your promises so that they're happy and they can pay you what you need to be paid. The issue was, the vehicle chassis and what we bought and what we loaded was not conducive. And we only saw that in application. As the vehicle started running, we saw it was consuming a lot more fuel. The wear and tear was not acceptable. And we had to actually, but it helped us. That failure helped us to say, we need to design a couple of different things in terms of the trailer. We didn't purchase the right trailer. We didn't purchase the right horse. Let's put in a different application and carry on. What was great is we could take that vehicle and put it in another short delivery span type of environment where it's short distance delivery, and what was being loaded was different. That made that vehicle profitable, and then we put in another vehicle that could be profitable on the long run. So that understanding, and it talks to in terms of fuel fleet management, routing and scheduling, whether it's dynamic or static, is very, very important. To our discussion today, whatever plan or whatever role or direction you take, the proper understanding of routing and scheduling your vehicle to do the application or service your customer is going to be paramount. It cannot be looked at in isolation. You have to look at the whole value chain. You have to look at the whole supply chain. And in doing that, you have to, once you've deployed the vehicle, understand through proper data analytics what is being said to you so that you can make those decisions to stop yourself from spending unintended resources.
That might help us actually look at things from maybe a big business, small business perspective, because I can imagine that comes up quite often. So from a big business, SBV, you know, probably lots of people that can analyze those things, budgets to try and test things and risk the failure, you can afford to fail in many ways. Heading over to EV Electric, which 3 years ago was a startup and now is you know, a small, medium business. How does that sound for you as EV Electric, but then also for your clients? Can you afford to take those tests and trials? Could you afford the errors along the way? Or has it been a lot easier to just get it right from day one?
Yeah, Ben, that's the dream, eh? Monday morning quarterback, get it right from day one. You know, you're the last boy looking at the rugby game over the weekend and saying you knew everything. Listen, Jonathan, you know, he's my dream client. You know, if you can find a fleet manager who understands the complexities of a total cost of ownership approach and is able to assess all the variables prior to adopting a new solution, that is like the ultimate, you know, in another world, Jonathan and I are probably on the same WhatsApp group, and you know, we definitely we talk the same language. So, from a startup perspective, Ben, when we have, you know, we've approached bigger clients strategically because we, in the hope of finding people like Jonathan who understand, they've got bigger fleets, they understand how numbers roll out and implications of the total cost of ownership, right? And that's how we, you know, our original hypothesis is that we're going to go for big customers doing big fleets. And on the whole, I would say the industry has been very positive in our approach, in that we haven't come with a black box solution. We've come with a very consultative approach to adopting electric vehicles. And from the start, the first thing I always say to stakeholders is, I can guarantee you we will not take your whole fleet. And in fact, I can almost guarantee you right now, we won't take the majority of your fleet electric. For example, at the moment, I'm busy with a client who's putting pressure for us to take more of their fleet electric as an initial tranche, and I'm pushing back saying, let's rather phase this thing, because, you know, speaking to Jonathan's understanding of total cost of ownership, if you look at electric vehicles, that, or in fact, you look at any fleet, you have petrol vehicles, which are cheaper than diesel vehicles below a certain kilometer mileage. Then diesel vehicles cross over, and diesel vehicles win for a number of kilometers over petrol vehicles and actually into perpetuity. But then diesel vehicles also have a crossover with electric vehicles, and electric vehicles then become you know, more viable. And a lot of fleet managers understand the diesel-petrol crossover. And so the electric diesel crossover also makes sense. So number one, I can tell you, everybody's knee-jerk reaction is, okay, take this little route that only does 50 kilometers a day and do it electric. And my answer is, no, that's not the route we want to take, because with a three-legged pokey of commercial, you're going to fall over. The electric vehicle doesn't make commercial sense with lower kilometers. Then on the flip side, you know, everybody gets excited. We do trials. So we, you know, we do a proof of concept with our clients prior to scaling. You know, we get a lot of data, you know, speaking to Jonathan's data analytics, we analyze. We also then understand that this thing looks amazing and it's getting cheaper and cheaper the more kilometers you do. But as soon as you hit the vehicle's and a single charge range per day, you then have an operational implication, right? Because if you can't go further than 300 kilometers on a single charge, you almost hit a ceiling there. If you can't charge it in day, and if you are charging it in day, you almost are assuming an operational change. Then yeah, the commercial leg standing, but the operations are starting to fall over. And so just by virtue of who we are, is we took this very consultative proof of concept approach. We started with our five EVs. Almost every client we work with, we first do trials and, you know, we get empirical data prior to scaling, and then we take that middle section. We don't take the lower kilometers and we don't take the higher kilometers. Technology will improve, you know, it will get cheaper, then we can take the lower. The battery is going to improve, we can take the higher. But right now, there is no reason not to adopt the fat middle in your fleet, because we know that it's operationally possible, it's commercially attractive. Technically, we will solve the issues, else we won't do it. And then the EV delivers on the promise, right? And then there's, you know, then it's green and it's all those good things. But, you know, I think to answer your question, you know, being a startup, I think has actually been in our favor, because we've made the decisions and we've just done it naturally you know, we've told the clients, we don't actually know. Here's our Excel. The Excel looks great, and the PowerPoint looks pretty, but let's put this in the fleet and try. And you know, that's what we did with Woolworths. We had, you know, 18 months, two vehicles running day in, day out, 7 days a week.
Is that because they had a, say, an objective to reach lower emission vehicles so they could play around with that? Or was it a conscious decision that they saw, say, a business case, a cost saving for it?
Ben, I think it started as a drive on green. So, you know, they definitely Woolworths are, they are looking to lead in decarbonizing, you know, their value chain as far as possible. But the conversation changed from adopting one or two vehicles or, you know, 10 vehicles into the fleet, where we've taken the majority of the Gauteng and Cape Town fleet now. That was a commercial decision. You know, it was like, oh, but this thing's actually cheaper. You know, it's kind of like solar, where the guys were kind of, okay, well, let's do some solar to reduce, okay, in South Africa, you know, there's other factors as well. But the electric vehicles in the right context now return commercial savings.
That's great.
And so that's, I would say, but the numbers was precipitated by the commercials. The initiation was precipitated by the need to go green.
So a lot of that we'll definitely look back to shortly, Paul, definitely around the infrastructure, because I think Steve's probably got quite a lot to say on that, which we'll look back to later. And then just around the cost and the business case, which sounds like it's quite attractive for your clients. We'll come back to that shortly.
Sorry, Ben, if I just may add my voice on, you know, your question on, you know, EV financing challenges, and I'll probably narrow it down, you know, to two-wheelers, and especially in the environment in East Africa, but I think this prevails also, you know, in the entire of Africa. So EV financing is actually intertwined with the adoption of EV. And if you look at it, we face a good number of challenges. So, for example, we have, you know, charging infrastructure challenges. Yeah. So we lack a comprehensive, you know, and accessible charging network, which remains critical. So this suppresses the demand for EV, for example, in East Africa, and therefore there is no need to finance it. So financing companies and even the intermediary financing, you know, institutions like ourselves are ready to finance EV, but this EV market challenges actually create, you know, sort of like suppresses the demand. There are also aspects like, you know, lack of EV supply, for example. Yeah, most bike manufacturers, you know, are actually startups with the low production capacities. Like I mentioned to you, you know, we also have an electric company in Uganda. And one of the things we are looking at is, you know, actually scaling it up in terms of production. There's also an element of consumer awareness. Yeah, so many potential users of EV do not understand the benefits, the long-term costings, savings, you know, and the likes, what we've discussed. There are elements like, you know, power instabilities, yeah, in Africa. I've also read a lot about it in South Africa. There's also regulatory framework, you know, which is also not quite favorable. There's also a lot of untested products, you know. There are many competitors who offer various different products, EVs, batteries, and most of these products, if you look at them, they're in the testing phase, and you know, there are questions around long-term durability and the likes. So we as financiers, we actually are seeing a suppression in demand as we speak because of these challenges. But if these challenges can be surmounted, then we are ready to finance.
That's really interesting points there around the two-wheelers. And I think, you know, for Jonathan and Paul, they're looking at it from a corporate perspective. Maybe there's a few key stakeholders that they have to influence. How does Watu go about, you know, influencing and acquiring customers on the thousand, tens of thousands of scales, as opposed to, you know, Paul, who might have a top list of 10 that he's targeting for 2024?
Yes, so actually our ice bikes portfolio at one point was tipping 350,000 active customers.
Wow.
And what we pride and do in Watu is, and we want to transition this, you know, to the electric element of it. So what we do as Watu is we do quick load. We are, first of all, we are accessible. Then we do quick loan processing. So we do our loan processes within the day. If you come to any of our branches, you meet any of our front office people, they'll be able to, you know, process this particular loan. And we strategically filled a gap, you know, that was not being offered, you know, by the traditional banks, that, you know, will do, you know, extended KYC and the likes. So that is basically the strategy that we have used. Of course, you know, we exercise a bit of caution because there are issues around non-performing loans and the likes. But also, I think what leverages us is, if you look at it, 90% of motorbikes in Kenya, be it ICE or EV, they're actually used for commercial purposes. Sure. So for us, we encourage you to come and give us your business case. And we can be able to see that you will be able to generate this income, this will be your cost, and we will be happy that you will be repaying the loan. Then we will support you, on that. So basically, we target the unbanked people.
Ben, do you mind if I just...
Please go ahead.
Steve, I'd be very interested in your, just at a fundamental level, do you ascribe a higher affordability to a guy who's adopting an EV bike or three-wheeler over an ICE? And sorry, maybe let me just explain this question a bit further. What I've seen from the banks that in South Africa, and you know, this is obviously coming from the four people that Jonathan carries money for, they have yet to understand the concept that the electric vehicle, bike, or three-wheeler is maybe 50% or, you know, 80% more expensive, but from an operational cost perspective, it's a lot less, right? So, you know, if on affordability calc, the guy normally qualifies for financing of 5,000 rand a month, that's assuming he's still going to spend another 5,000 in fuel, right? Whereas now the bike is going to cost him 8,000 and electricity is going to cost him maybe 500. It's only 8,500, but you know, previously he was paying 10,000 and he afforded a 5,000 rand finance. Now they won't give him finance for 8,500, right? Because for 8,000 and the 500 electricity. Do you guys have a higher threshold then, or adjust your affordability when they're adopting an electric? A three-wheeler or two-wheeler?
Yeah, so I'll answer your question in two parts. So yes, we see a higher affordability for EV bikes. Okay. And you know, the basis of this is the fact that for us, we view electric bikes to be less risky in terms of non-performing loans. Because okay. if you look at electric bikes, they have various advantages as compared to ICE bikes, which is basically the internal combustion engine bikes. So number one, and especially around the control element. So we use IoT, you know, to sort of like switch off and on the engine of an electric bike if we have a defaulter. So we are quite confident that, you know, we'll be able, you know, to trace a defaulter as compared to an ICE bike that we put trackers, and sometimes they remove the trackers and, you know, take them to certain regions and leads to a higher, you know, non-performing loan levels. So this particular element, and also there's also the technology around, we use battery as a service, which basically means that we use the swap model, whereby you come, you bring us your depleted battery, and we give you a fully charged one. Now, the batteries will have unique identifiers. When you are changing them, then we'll be able to trace you in our systems and, you know, probably tell you that you're a defaulter and probably hold on to the battery. And the batteries ideally are not interoperable. So that control elements gives us less risk. But also, if I may answer, you know, the second part of your question, it is true that the capital outlay of an electric bike, and let me use a motorbike, is much more than an ICE bike. Basically, initially we started it being 2x or 2 times. So if a bike is 180,000 Kenya shillings, you find the battery is 180,000. But you know, with improved R&D, we've seen, you know, new technologies come in, battery scores have gone down, and right now I think it's at not 2x but 1.7 times that, and you know, with more R&D we'll bring it down. But on the converse also, now we have fuel, which is double the price of charging an electric vehicle. So if you look at this, and if you put, you know, all of them, if you mix them and get an average for us in the long run, you find that an electric bike is more, you know, more efficient, you know, for some of our customers. There might be an initial capital outlay that is high, but as they continue to operate it, then they will for sure accrue the benefits that come, you know, with EV.
That's a brilliant question, Paul, and it leads a question that I have around who is currently sharing knowledge and educating the financiers around these types of learnings, because they may or may not know that they've got this huge additional business model sat right under their nose because their customers' affordability rate has just gone up. So, you know, is that something that you're having to do, Paul, when you knock on their door, or is there a general sense of education and awareness that's growing each year because they're taking the time to understand?
Ben, I find the banks are, they're an interesting dichotomy where you've got the front end of the bank, the deal makers that are excited and interested in financing fleets, you know, and this is, you know, this is where we are. It's fleets and individuals. I think individuals are going to be even a bigger challenge. And so the front end of the bank and the deal makers are very much looking to do it. But, you know, Steve's definitely, you know, you can hear he comes from this financing space. The banks are all about risk, right? And so if you're able to suitably mitigate risk, then, you know, the other side, so I called it a dichotomy because you've got the front end that are keen to do the deal, then you've got credit. You know, there's credit committees and there's decision makers that sit behind some sort of impenetrable wall, and credit mitigates risk currently through very smart actuaries and historical data. You know, and you know, if you impute risk into the system, then there's two knee-jerk reactions: increase cost or reject the deal entirely because, you know, we cannot compute the underlying risk of this. And so, you know, who's educated or is the bank moving forward? I'd say yes, the front end of the bank wants to move forward, and, you know, there's a number of decision makers that are getting progressive and that work green financing solutions. We are still trying to get the credit guys over the line in terms of risk. And there are unfortunately a number of things in their world which we just don't currently have. You know, 5 years data in the secondhand value of a 5-year-old electric vehicle, commercial electric vehicle. You know, they haven't been around for 5 years. So that's a 10-year time horizon that, yeah, unfortunately, you know, unless we have a DeLorean and we can fly to the future and bring back the data for them, we can't overcome that, right? So you have to use mitigating things. Also the affordability side of things is, you know, we know that I'm interested to see that the 2 and 3 wheelers are twice as fuel efficient or electricity efficient as fuel in terms of cost. From a commercial fleet perspective, we're seeing that it's between 5 times to 8 times more efficient from a cost perspective, you know, just on the fuel and services and running costs are also less. So the data which we produce to the bank showing them that it's a lot cheaper is also, you know, it's informative, but I don't think it's necessarily, it's not being trusted yet because it's not substantial enough, right? And then an actuary, he does his calcs for a very good reason, and unfortunately there isn't all the numbers that an actuary needs, and so it results in risk, and risk then pushes up price, and risk then, you know, rejects deals. And so
And what would you all like to see from a regulation policy perspective, or a certain change that might help those credit providers provide credit to, whether it's SBB, UATU or Evelectric? What are the changes needed?
Yeah, I'm sure Steve will have quite a lot of regulatory inputs from
sure.
their side.
Sure. So yeah, so Ben, there's a lot that the government can do, you know, to spur, you know, uptake of EVs and as well as, you know, financiers. But again, to my previous point is that if there's uptake, then the financiers are ready to finance. So government, basically what they need to do is to spur the uptake by, you know, the customers that we have. So the government can give, you know, tax concessions and subsidies. So in Kenya, for example, there's a push for, you know, VAT exemption on what I mentioned, CKDs, which is completely knocked down, which is basically the people who bring in parts and assemble, similar to what we do, you know, in Uganda. There are also talks, you know, about, you know, government encouraging a development of, you know, charging stations and swap stations. So that can they be able to give free land or maybe free leasehold land, yeah? And the second aspect that I think the government can, you know, play a crucial role in supporting, you know, the uptake and the financing of EVs is basically closing the knowledge gap, you know, basically through awareness creation. There's a lot of myths around EV, especially for us in two-wheelers, three-wheelers, on the batteries. So there are some quarters that say that the batteries lack power. So if you're going uphill, you know, it's a challenge. Some of them say that the distance, you know, is quite short and, you know, covers only 40 kilometers and, you know, there are not enough swap stations. Other people have raised the safety concerns in terms of, you know, the batteries flaring up and the likes. And I think there was just one incident that I think somebody, you know, sort of like misused their batteries in Kenya, and social media was all over the place. So two things, tax concessions, subsidies, and creating awareness by the government would really help.
Great. And you're the treasurer on the EMAC, the E-Mobility Association of Kenya. Are you finding that that association is supporting the transition and helping achieve some of those goals for financing?
Definitely. So I sit in the Governance Council as the treasurer of the Electric Mobility Association of Kenya. And we are at the center of, you know, drafting these policies and getting, you know, all the input from the stakeholders. So we're just concluding a white paper whereby we'll be submitting to the government task force, you know, with all these particular elements. So we've captured in there, you know, tax concessions that we think are needed to spur the, you know, the EV industries. We've put in, you know, the do's, the don'ts, where the, you know, the government can partner. We've also spoken to investors, you know, key stakeholders in the business, like, you know, the founders of WATU, who have a lot of in-depth knowledge on EV and the likes. And yeah, we will be presenting this to the government and partnering with the government in terms of sparring EV to launch. Yeah.
And sorry, Tim, if you can jump in there. One of the things that was interesting in terms of the, from a South African perspective, from the finance minister's pronouncements last week and NAMSA's sort of reaction or press release to that, from a South African perspective, we really need to move into the right direction. And we need to make sure that the policies that we want to implement are actually implemented as of yesterday. We need clarity and the, you know, the destruction of the ambiguity that sometimes prevails. Messaging to the industry. If we look at the automotive industry as it sits, and this dovetails greatly with our discussion today, is that even if there is interest in electric vehicles from a passenger vehicle perspective, or, you know, from a commercial vehicle perspective, those incentives from a tax perspective that Steve speaks about needs to be clear and demonstrable for the manufacturers to actually take it up. If you look at the South African context as well, we are a great exporter of automotive vehicles and automotive vehicle parts. So in terms of the trajectory, dovetailing with the UN sustainability goals, you will find that as a market, we will continue to lose in terms of GDP if we don't move in alignment with the global market, because they're moving from Euro 4 to Euro 7 very, very quickly. And if we don't adapt, we won't be able to be sustainable. And also with the Euro 3, 4, and 5s, the really obsolescence becomes an issue if you look at it from a South African perspective, that they won't be supported by the international manufacturers. I was talking to people from Hino, and talking about their perspective and how they're looking at it. And they have direction from their mother company in Japan. You look at Volvo, you look at all the other members. It cannot be a nice to have anymore. We have to have policy that is very, very clear and text that is very, very, supportive of the manufacturing and the implementation. And that moves as well and dovetailing into the infrastructure development plans that we have been negating or been rather very slow in implementing. So from a continental perspective, you look at Ethiopia, you look at what Steve has mentioned about Kenya, there is progress. From a South African perspective, we have to make sure in our engagements with government that we make it abundantly clear that this has a very direct implication to our GDP. Transport and logistics constitutes a large number of the GDP, and also the manufacturing and exporting of vehicles and components also contributes a large number to the South African economy. So
yeah.
When we look at Africa and we look at the new Africa Free Trade Agreement, and we look at what we want to do in terms of making sure that our companies in the continents are sustainable in the long term, we have to make sure that policy is clear, it is direct, and actually there are mechanisms that will encourage companies to move into this direction, because it will affect the whole entire value chain, the whole entire supply chain. If you look at companies that are multinational, for example, they have ESG components that are linked, and they have 2030 strategies, 2050 strategies, in alignment of what is happening globally. If we fall short or we procrastinate even further, we will be left behind, and this will have a disastrous impact to our future. Thanks.
Thanks, Jonathan. Great points. And yeah, something that probably isn't discussed enough of is the amount of foreign exchange, imbalance of trade for countries that are just spending so much on fuel. Oil is the largest import for South Africa as it stands, the largest commodity. All of those rands leaving the country to buy oil. Ethiopia has taken that decision recently to ban import of petrol and diesel because there was too much money leaving and there were exchange rate issues. I'm being flagged for Q&A, so I think there's quite a few questions coming in from the audience, which we will go to in just a second. I did just want to touch briefly on infrastructure and on ESG and carbon tax. So maybe if we just zoom out quickly, the COP 28, 29, global commitments. It sounds like lots of money's flowing around the world to support green growth and green jobs. Just briefly from anyone really, in terms of experience around that, how is that translating down to your business from a, say, a carbon tax or emissions or ESG? Like, how is that making a business difference to you right now?
If I jump into that one, for SPVB owned by the four major banks, the banks have a very specific, clear path in terms of ESG, not just in terms of carbon emissions, but for, the governance aspect of it. And one of the key areas as it dovetails to fleet management is people might be enticed to look at the tax breaks in terms of a carbon tax and what is future pronouncements that are going to be made. But it is absolutely important for us as fleet managers, for supply chain professionals, for logistics professionals, to understand, to clean upon the data that is there, but to make sure that data is correct. Because a lot of people take the opinion of just using a formula to calculate CO2 emissions or burn rate. But the issue then is, what are we doing with the telematics data? What are we doing with the dash camera data? What are we doing with all these data sets? Anyone who's in fleet management will tell you the biggest issue in fleet management is you've got a plethora of data, but if you don't organize it, stratify it, to understand it, to make those empirical decisions, you won't. How does that combine with carbon tax? Is that you can actually look from a make perspective, from a euro perspective. But most important, one of the things that we leave out in these discussions is the people element. How do you train your drivers? How do you how does the people who work for you understand how is CO2 calculated? What mitigating operational steps can be taken based on data to be able to manage it properly? And once you've done that, making sure that data is empirical so that when you submit for carbon tax, you are ESG compliant, because nothing is more problematic from a governance perspective to submit numbers that are wrong, and we can blame the governments till we're blue in the face. But we have to make sure that even at this current trajectory or this current juncture, as organizations, we make sure that the calculations that we do are actually correct. So I was in a summit the other day with women in business that was organized by a friend of mine, Nikki Scott, and I was telling the team that you have to clean the data. You cannot ignore the data, you have to use the data. Now that speaks to what you said, Ben, about bigger companies, and look at SMEs. In the value chain, if you're connected to a multinational anywhere in the supply chain, they will track the carbon emissions.
Yeah,
so now,
some really good points in there. And I think you've opened up a whole other can of worms, which is data, which we didn't even get to touch on, and we won't be able to expand on it today, but it sounds like that's a really important part of everything that Jonathan, Paul, and Steve is doing, that data's key. Just very briefly to Steve and Paul, just a yes or no answer would be great for the carbon tax and ESG. But are you actually using any carbon tax or ESG tools at this point in time to basically accelerate your business?
Yeah, so if I may go first, for the quick answer is yes, definitely, because like I mentioned, you know, we are also financed, you know, by debt investors, and a lot of them are quite keen on ESG elements and even the carbon tax, or rather the carbon emission side, yeah.
Thanks. And Paul, anything that you've been able to tap into today?
I would say from a commercial perspective, ESG drives the decision, or at least catalyzes decisions. From a carbon tax advantage, from a financial perspective, we have yet to unlock the carbon tax or any financial benefits from carbon tax, just because the current constructs and cost of auditing and verifying have just been unviable for where we are at the moment. So we hope to do that in future, but right now the answer is yes, it drives commercials, but no, it doesn't give us any financial benefits.
Okay, so we've got a question that's come from, I hope I'm pronouncing the name right, but Mikhail Berger here, and it's a great question because it was the point I was going to go on to next, which was around some of the infrastructure stuff. But the question is, charging and range can be an issue, especially for B2B market who need to drive all day, as Paul has mentioned earlier today. Is this a problem in practice to achieving total cost of ownership improvement versus the internal combustion engine options? And what are some of the options to solve this?
I'd like to just quickly answer, yeah. The charging and range is... those aren't the issues, right? They are realities. It's the lack of understanding of either of those two. So, you know, we ensure there's fully charged vehicles every morning. And from a commercial perspective, I'd spoken earlier about, you know, the top and the tail, and we cut those two off. So we try not to line ourselves up for failure. That said, we do have two vehicles in the fleet of, you know, of, and I'm specifically speaking about Woolworths vehicles that every day go over our single charge range. And we deal with that not in a way, everyone has this perception of going to your garage and filling your tank up. That is not necessarily the right approach. You've got to, again, let's go back to Jonathan's very smart fleet thinking. You use data and you charge opportunistically. And so with 10 minutes of charge en route in the day, we get an extra 80 kilometers of range, which, you know, so then we can get to 380 with a one tonner in a day. And that Woolworths vehicle, or those two, we manage them, right? So it is a challenge if you're uninformed and you're not monitoring.
Are you finding it affecting the TCO at all, or is it just it's baked into it and you're still getting a very attractive business case?
And we bake it in. So, you know, we before adopting for a client, we understand where we require charging. We invest in charging at the client site and in ancillary locations. And we have a bit of a shared asset economy, you know. So we, you know, we've got Woolworths, we've got DSV, we've got Nightwing, we've got FedEx, a number of clients. And so we have a shared asset economy approach. And we also rely on the public charging infrastructure guys. You know, the shared asset economy is the way to unlock this thing. It's not, you know, you can't have a one-to-one charger ratio and expect to have a improvement on your TCO.
Brilliant. So I'm sure Jonathan's happy to hear that kind of information. And I think for Steve, you've already solved that problem because you're doing battery swapping. So infrastructure is a very small cost to the additional TCO for you. Just heading straight over to another question, actually, because around APR and some of the rates here, so I'll just pop this up. It's from Roland here, and it's directed to Steve. So he says most EV operators need an APR of around 40% to 50% to make this high CapEx, low OpEx model work. Do you think that the high interest rates are a barrier for massive scale-up?
Yeah, so definitely if I look at it, the high interest rates, you know, will be, you know, a barrier. But for us, like I mentioned, intermediary financiers, the rate that we charge is higher than commercial banks, but we really don't believe that, you know, it's a high interest rate because it's a bundled product. So if I speak specifically about the two-wheelers. So whenever we give a loan or finance a two-wheeler, there are many other activities that we are engaged in. So for example, we will put for you a GPS tracker, you know, to be able to track if the, you know, the bike is lost, helps both you and us. We will take insurance on that particular bike, you know, again, for, you know, security reasons. We will give you riding gear. We will, you know, train you on safety elements. We will process for you the ownership documents, which we in this side of the world we call logbooks. So I don't really think, I think in East Africa at least, and in the markets that we've been in, we've noticed that, you know, the barrier to, you know, massive scale up is accessibility to financing. And as long as we make ourselves, our finances to be accessible, compared to, you know, traditional banks, then we've seen an uptick of the loans and, you know, purchase of this particular, you know, vehicles. And the same we are also seeing, you know, in EV. What people want is access to finance, especially, you know, the lower carded people in society.
That's brilliant. We've actually reached the end of our journey for today. There's so many questions answered, but so many that are left unanswered. I think we'll probably have more and more questions from here. There's even some other questions that have come in, Zambian Electric Mobility Innovation Alliance. So we can't get to that question now, but what we'll do is when we do share this video in the next few days on YouTube and our website, we'll post that question in and then the panelists can answer that. So I'm just going to do a very quick one sentence because we really do have to wrap up now. But I'd just love to know from the panelists, what would be the silver bullet for this year to really accelerate the financing of electric fleets so we can hit that scale? If I start with Jonathan, just the one-liner silver bullet.
Data integration and proof of concepts that would really help.
Brilliant. Over to Evelectric, which is maybe the king of proof of concepts right now with some of the pilots you've been doing. One sentence, silver bullet.
The SPV being landed as a client for us. And we've got a lot of data and proof of concepts.
There you go.
That too, but I think also banks getting their dichotomy to merge into a logical future-focused approach at financing both fleets and individuals. and maybe not even banks, maybe, you know, the Watu credits of the world looking to South African markets with a progressive financing thinking rather than the traditional way.
Brilliant. I sense we're doing some business already on this call. There's a deal pending. There's a new partnership pending as well. Steve, Watu credit, what's the silver bullet this year that is going to help accelerate financing electric fleets?
Yeah, so for me, it's very clear. I will encourage, you know, traditional banks that some of us as Watu Credit intermediary financiers depend on, you know, for investment, for debt investment. So as much as they might not have the appetite to go last mile, we have the appetite to go last mile. All they have to do is to partner with us. And then we will be able to achieve that. And same goes with the government. The government should also, you know, support intermediary asset financing institutions like Watu Credit. And I think that we are the ones who reach the last mile, and especially talking about, you know, the two-wheelers and the three-wheelers and the likes.
Brilliant, brilliant. So we discussed many things today, some of the key outcomes. Fleet management is a science. Here we were joined by three scientists that are really testing things to advance how we're financing electric fleets in Africa. So thank you so much for my panelists joining me today. It's been a very fruitful discussion. I can see how the financing element of this industry is going to play such a big role in what we do at Smarter Mobility Africa Summit. I think we need a lot more of this type of summit in October. And we really look forward to serving the industry more across the year. So there'll be an email coming around with a summary of what happened today and also a summary of the activities for the Smarter Mobility Africa platform. Thanks, everyone. Have a great day. And let's get out there financing electric fleets.
Thanks.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
Brilliant. So just...